there are some decisions that change the course of our lives. Marriage, for example, the decision to get married, that changes the rest of your life. At least it's supposed to. Seems like it's popular today to only have it change your life until you get bored and then you bail out on it. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. The decision to get married is a life-changing decision. So is the decision to follow the Lord. At least it's supposed to be. As we've talked about the last few weeks, it would seem that there are a whole lot of people who would consider themselves Christians, and I'm certainly in no position to question the genuineness of their faith, but they would have us believe that simply praying the prayer and, you know, maybe getting dunked or sprinkled or dipped or whatever, and then you have this sort of fire insurance policy that says that when you die, you get to go to heaven, and that's the end of it. That's as far as they go. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. This decision to follow the Lord is a life-changing decision. You know, decisions with that much impact often involve some kind of reminder, you know, a memorial of some sort, a marker. In marriage, it's probably mainly the ring would be common. Of course, I don't have one because my finger turns green and itches. So it's in a box at home. But you understand, you know, that ring. In fact, people think about their marriage or their wedding ceremony, and they, you know, they remember what it was, you know, the ceremony, and he remembers how great she looked coming down the aisle with her dad, and she remembers as the first time she'd ever, last time she'd ever seen him all cleaned up in a tux. That ring, you know, helps you remember that. In fact, whenever I do a wedding, there's part of the ceremony in the rings where I say that every time you look at that ring, it'll remind you of the love that was pledged to you this day. And so that ring really is a reminder of that, a reminder of the whole thing. You know, I wonder what would happen if married couples, starting from their wedding day, once a month, got out a copy of their wedding vows and just kind of reread it. You know, for the first couple of months, it would be all mushy and, ooh, you know, I promise to love and cherish and obey and, you know, honor, richer for poorer, you know, sickness, health, all that stuff. But, man, if you did that once a month for your whole, you know, for the rest of your life, possibly marriages would last a lifetime the way that they're supposed to. That ring, you know, and those vows, it gives you something to remember. When people choose to follow the Lord, a lot of the times, that event that kind of locks them in their mind is their baptism. You know, maybe they heard a message at church or on the radio or on Christian television or a friend shared with them or whatever it was. That baptism, you know, is that occasion that you look back on and you remember your family and your friends are gathered around, and you know, some of them really can't believe it's you. I mean, sometimes you can't believe it's you, you know? But in that baptism, you demonstrate publicly to the whole world that you've made a once and for all decision to follow Jesus, to put him first in everything, all day, every day. Make him the center of your life. Or like that little Four Spiritual Laws tract says, put him on the throne of your life. And for a lot of people, looking back on that baptism is that memorial. It's that marker. There's a day on the calendar and a memory of down by the river or in the tub or wherever it might be that kind of locks that decision in for them. The Bible is full of occasions that have been memorialized in some way. Turn back with me to Genesis chapter 9. Hold your place in Joshua. The 9th chapter of Genesis. And we'll just look at two of these, actually, to get the idea. Genesis 9, verse 12. He's talking to Noah here. And God said, "This is the sign of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. You know, God placed that rainbow as a memorial, as a marker, as a reminder of his promise to never again destroy the earth with a flood. The next time the Lord destroys the earth, it'll be with fire. And can't wait for that for that to happen. We won't read there, but if you up in Genesis 31, you remember Jacob and Laban, his father-in-law, and how Laban kind of out-tricked the trickster, you know, out-snuck the sneak. And next thing you know, he's got, you know, not 7 years, not 14 years, but, you know, around 20 or better than 20 years working for his father-in-law. And finally, he packs up, they make an agreement, and he packs up his family and his possessions, and he takes off. Well, Laban doesn't like this. Laban comes chasing after Jacob and his tribe. But once they come to terms with one another, in chapter 31 of Genesis, they pile up some rocks, and those rocks are that memorial. Whenever we see these rocks, well, they serve two purposes. One, they were a marker of the territory, kind of a boundary marker, but really they were a memorial to the agreement, to the covenant that they had made. And we see that again and again. Abraham did it, Moses did it, Jacob more than once, piling up rocks as a memorial, as a trigger, so that they would remember, see those rocks and go, oh yeah, I remember that's when Laban and I got together and we, you know, made this agreement and decided we could get along. Well, in the fourth chapter of Joshua here, we read about two meaningful memorials. And what we take away from this chapter is a lesson on the importance of reminders, memorials, to keep us on track as we move into the fullness of all the Lord has for us. Now, we're going to break this into three sections, one at a time. Verses 1 through 9 teach us that sometimes it's important to remember the decision. Sometimes it's crucial to have a reminder, a memorial, a marker of a decision that you've made. Joshua 4:1, and it came to pass, when all the people had completely crossed over the Jordan, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, take for yourselves 12 men from the people, one man from every tribe, and command them, saying, take for yourselves 12 stones from here, out of the midst of the Jordan, from the place where the priest's feet stood firm. You shall carry them over with you and leave them in the lodging place where you lodge tonight. And then Joshua called the 12 men whom he had appointed from the children of Israel, one man from every tribe. And Joshua said to them, cross over before the ark, or in front of the ark is what he means, the ark of the Lord your God, into the midst of the Jordan, and each one of you take up a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, that this may be a sign among you when your children ask in time to come, saying, what do these stones mean to you? Then you shall answer them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord when it crossed over the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be for a memorial to the children of Israel forever. And the children of Israel did so, just as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones from the midst of the Jordan, as the Lord had spoken to Joshua, according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, and carried them over with them to the place where they lodged, and laid them down there. Then Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant stood, and they're there to this day. Now, if you weren't with us last week, maybe just a quick review would be helpful. The people of Israel have wandered in the desert for 40 years. That doubting, disobedient generation, all but two of them, have died off. And now it's time for Joshua and his sort of second-in-command, Caleb, to lead these people, 2.5 million people, into the land that God promised not only Moses, but promised all the way back to Abraham. The land I will give you, the land flowing with milk and honey. And so there they are at Acacia Grove on the east side of the, east side of the Jordan. And the river's at flood stage. I mean, it's bad enough you got to cross the river, but it's at flood stage. How are they going to do this? Well, the Lord told them to have the priest take up the ark. And when the priest feet are in the water, you know, when the bottom of their feet touch the water will stop, and that's exactly how it happened, and the priests marched out to the middle on dry ground, and then 2.5 million Israelites enter into the promised land, enter into the land that God promised Abraham. And chapter 4 here is kind of retelling that story with some detail. Now, verses 1 through 8 tells us about these 12 stones. These 12 stones that were on the bank, you know, he said, go out where the priests are in the middle and pick these stones up. He said, put them on your shoulder. So we're not talking about little, you know, skip across the water. We're talking about big rocks. They have to be hauled on your shoulder. And you stack them up right there, and they were easy to see. Everybody who came by could see those 12 stones stacked up. Now, in chapter 3, verse 12, I told you last week this would come in handy. He says, therefore take for yourselves 12 men from the tribes of Israel. The point is he picked these 12 guys before they crossed over. And now that they're crossing over, it's those 12 in verse 2, where he says again, take for yourselves 12 men from the people, one man from every tribe, and they go out to the middle of the now dry river, pick up these big stones, big enough that you have to heft it on your shoulder, and they stack them up. Now, the significance of that is that every Israelite, every one of the 2.5 million Israelites that are there, one of those stones is the stone of their tribe. It's not just this random pile of rocks. That's our stone. We're from this tribe or that tribe, and that's our stone. You know, every one of them had a rock that they could look, not only look at, but relate to and kind of have ownership of. That's my rock. You know, that's our rock. They can relate to it personally. And then in verse 8, it tells them that he laid them down at the end of the verse. That word translated laid them down can be translated or would be transliterated rested there, which is a great symbol of you move in to the promised land. You move in out of the desert. You know, you don't just have fire insurance faith, but you move in towards the fullness of the promises of God. And what do you find there? Rest. Rest from your labor. So the 12 stones on the bank, they were easy to see. Now, verse 9 talks about 12 other stones that Joshua set up in the middle. And of course, after the priests came across and the water began to flow again, those stones would have been covered up. They weren't so easy to see. You knew they were there, but you couldn't see them. And what that is a great picture of what Paul wrote about in Colossians chapter 2 when he said, he's talking about burying the old life, you know, as you come across the boundary, you know, the river there, into the new life, you bury the old life under the water. And he uses baptism as a picture of that. Colossians 2 says, you were also buried with him, that is Jesus, in baptism, in which you also were raised with him through faith in the working of God who raised him from the dead. You were buried with him, and then you were raised with him through faith. There's always going to be an element of faith required in following the Lord. There's always going to be something that you can't see, that you can't touch, that you can't prove. And we've had this discussion before. I love those science shows, whether it's archaeology or geology or one of the ologies. And, you know, as we said last week, the scientists are going out of their way to accidentally prove that God is real and his word is true. And there are a whole lot of examples of that. And I love to watch those shows. But, you know, whether it's an excavation at an ancient site or one of those things like the Shroud of Turin, you know, interesting little thing, probably not the real deal, but, you know. And somebody says, well, we found the, you know, the Holy Grail, the cup from the Last Supper, or we know where the Ark of the Covenant is. It's in Ethiopia, you know. Okay, you know, it's interesting stuff. But, you know, the thing is, whether you have that much proof, scientific, you know, scientifically what, a validated truth, or whether you have a mountain of scientifically validated proof about the claims of the Bible, there's always going to be that point where faith is required. And I think that's God's design. You know, if we could prove the Shroud of Turin was really the shroud that Jesus was wrapped in after his crucifixion, I guess that would go a long way for skeptics and doubters. But where would faith fit in if we had all those scientific proofs? I mean, you know, what if, it's a big what if, but if somebody had a video camera, you know, on that third day after the crucifixion and they rolled away the stone and there were these bright lights like angels and the tomb was empty. I mean, would that be enough proof? For some people it might be, or it might put us in the right direction, but there's always going to be a requirement of faith. And what's that's significant because those rocks were there. That memorial was there, but that second memorial is, it's under the water. You can't see it. You kind of have to choose to believe it without the evidence or apart from the evidence. That's also a picture of the Spirit works in our lives. There are changes brought about by the Spirit of God that may not be visible. Seems like we always want to start from the outside in. You know, Lord, change me. You deliver me from this habit or change this part of my personality or, you know, fix this and heal that. But the Lord has a list that's a whole nother set of priorities. The Lord is saying, maybe we need to work on this attitude. Maybe we need to work on, you know, this other thing. And so, you know, the Spirit's at work, but you can't see it. It's such a slow thing. It's kind of like, you know, we've talked about from Romans 12, don't be conformed to the world, but be transformed. You know, it's the, be metamorphosed. Well, when that caterpillar builds that cocoon, you can't see what's going on in there. But you know that there's an incredible transformation happening. Kind of a picture of those rocks under the water. You know they're there. You can't see what's going on, but you know that they're there. Now, when we surrender our lives to Jesus, it means stepping out of the past into the future. Now, for some of us, that's easy. I mean, some of us are crying for help. You know, save me, help, rescue me. You know, you don't have to convince me. I've hit bottom and I've learned my lesson and I'm opening my life to you, Lord. And I'm not only accepting you, but I'm pleading with you. Help me out here. You know, heal me. There are others though, you know, that surrender, that leaving the past and stepping into the future is kind of a scary proposition. I mean, you know, they're thinking, oh, my life's not so bad. It could be better, but you know, I'm not in a crisis. I'm not in an emergency. And, you know, the fullness of fellowship with the Creator sounds good, but is it going to get in the way of what I want to do? Is it going to mess up my agenda? Is it, you know, see, whether you look forward to those changes or whether you're not sure about them, it's a decision that has to be made to step out of the past into the future. See, stepping out of the past means leaving the flesh-driven life. That'd make a good book title, wouldn't it? You know, the purpose-driven life, the flesh-driven life. That's an easier one to write because that's what's going on all around us. You know, the flesh-driven life where it's me first. It's all about me. and everything you do, how it affects me, and whether it's the government or the economy or the, you know, the guy down the street or whatever, it's all about me. It's all about me. It's all about me. You know, that's what the flesh-driven life is all about. And even religious practices and religious disciplines can be done in the flesh. And Psalms refers to those things as a polluted offering. You know, the Lord says, you're not worshiping me, you're worshiping you. You're not loving me, you're loving yourself for your own sake. That's what it means to step out of the past, to leave that flesh-driven life. Now, stepping into the future means entering the Spirit-led life, which is a life where Jesus is first. It's Jesus first, and then everybody else, and then me last. That's the Spirit-led life. And see, when you step into that, the future God has for you, even the smallest thing can be an act of devotion and worship. See, where if it's flesh-driven, even the most, you know, these gigantic, dynamic, profound, you know, people build buildings and hospitals and kingdoms supposedly for the Lord, dedicated to the Lord, but really it's just a flesh-driven thing. But when you step into that future God has for you and it's Him first, then everybody else and me last, then even just the subtlest, the tiniest little thing can be pure devotion, pure worship. You know, appreciating the beauty of a flower or enjoying the warmth of the sun on your face, which we get about 4 days a year. But, you know, it feels good while it lasts, you know, and that, even that kind of thing, the smallest thing, listening to a friend without offering advice, just so they can vent, just so they can get the burden off, and you just love them and smile, and that's what it means to step into the future. The decision to step out of the past into the future is something we need to be reminded of. And that's where those 12 stones on the bank come in. See, if the people of Israel, if they got discouraged or they thought the battle was too tough, or maybe, you know, there might be a few crazy ones who actually would rather live in the desert for some reason. You know, it doesn't make sense. But they would go back and they would see those stones and they'd be reminded, oh yeah, the miracle that God did. He parted that water, and you know, when the ark went out and we crossed over, it wasn't even muddy, the ground was dry, and their faith, you know, is kind of re-triggered or rebuilt, and so they're, you know, I'm not gonna go back, I'm gonna hang in here, I'm gonna do this thing with the Lord. You know, you see that reminder and you remember the desert. You remember where you came from. And that's why that memorial is so important. We need something to remind us. Remember the miracle. You know, and then you get that encouragement to just keep moving forward. Just keep moving forward. Remember the decision. Now, verses 10 through 19 give us a more detailed look at the crossing and point out that sometimes it's also important to remember the day or remember the date. Verse 10, so the priests who bore the ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord had commanded Joshua to speak to the people, according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua. And the people hurried and crossed over. Then it came to pass, when all the people had completely crossed over, that the ark of the Lord and the priests crossed over in the presence of the people. And the men of Reuben, the men of Gad, the half-tribe of Manasseh, crossed over armed before the children of Israel, and Moses has spoken to them. Now, if you remember the story, these 2.5 tribes had settled for land on the east side as their inheritance. And the deal was made that because they weren't going to enter into this promised land, that they would go before Israel, you know, armed and be the first ones in battle as Israel moves in to the promised land. It says about 40,000, verse 13, prepared for war, crossed over before the Lord for battle to the plains of Jericho. On that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they feared him as they had feared Moses all the days of his life. Then the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, command the priests who bear the ark of the testimony to come up from the Jordan. Joshua therefore commanded the priests, saying, come up from the Jordan. And it came to pass, when the priests who bore the ark of the covenant of the Lord had come from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet touched the dry land, that the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and overflowed all its banks as before. Now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. Maybe you can see what he's doing here. He's telling the story sort of over and over. This is the third time he's told the story, but adds a little more detail each time. Kind of reminds me of Genesis 1 and 2, where Genesis 1 kind of paints the big picture and Genesis 2 backs up and tells us about the same thing, only with a lot more detail. Anyway, verses 10 through 19 here, sometimes it's important to remember the date. Do you remember your spiritual birthday? A lot of us do. Some people don't. I talked to a guy once. He was in our church in La Center. Actually, he was the guy that ran sound. And he was a part of the church. He was there every week, you know, for years, and rock solid guy. And I remember one Sunday at the end of the service, I didn't plan it, but we all prayed the sinner's prayer together. You know, instead of having people come forward or anything, we just all prayed it, you know, dear Lord, I confess. And we did this thing. And then after the service, the guy came up to me and said, you know, that's the first time I've ever done that. Part of the church, serving the Lord, you know, a giver, all those things, and had never actually done that. And I said, well, you can know that today is the day. You know, now you have a spiritual birthday. Or maybe it's an anniversary, you know, of your deliverance from a hurt or a habit or a hang-up. I mean, I sure remember that in my life. It's an easy day to remember, July 4th, 1986. It's cheating because it's such a holiday, but I remember, you know, back in those days I was divorced and I was an unlicensed pharmaceuticals representative. Self-employed, and was my own best customer, which often happens to those kinds of guys. And, you know, I'd kind of flirted with the things of God about a year before that. But the thing is, I tried to walk the walk in my own strength. I didn't understand about the Spirit or relying and resting in the Lord. And so, of course, I gave it my best shot. After a few months, I fell. And then I didn't fall off the wagon. I dove, you know, right back into a big pile of white powder. And I was strung out. There's just no other way to say it. I snorted coke all day, every day, sold it and bought it back from the guy I sold it to, because that's how stupid that stuff makes you. And it was the 4th of July, 1986, and my sister called me. We were sitting in the backyard. Now, I was reading this book. Remember, about a year before that, I had kind of flirted with the things of God but had fallen away. Very quickly. But I had this Christian book, and it was by a guy named Fritz Reidenauer. And it was called How to Be a Christian Without Being Religious. Because I wanted to be a Christian, but man, I did not want to be religious. And I didn't know that it was possible to be one without the other, you know. So I've got this book and I'm reading it, and what it turns out, what it really is a commentary on Romans. I didn't know what a commentary was and I didn't know what Romans was, but I'm reading this book and I'm sitting in a lawn chair in the backyard. Long story short, my sister calls me up. Hey, what are you doing? Well, I'm just sitting in the backyard waiting to die. Well, aren't you in a good mood, you know? And it's like, well, really, that's about, you know, I'm not doing anything. I got nothing going. I got no irons in the fire. I'm just putting in time. And whether it's next week or 50 more years from now, I'm just waiting around until time to die. And then she was, you know, well, nice talking to you, you know, and hung up. And I got back into this book and I came across that verse that said, there's no temptation, you know, has overtaken you that you haven't been provided a way out. And he went on to explain in the book, You either believe that or you don't. Now, if you don't believe it, then it ain't going to work for you. But if you do believe it, if God says there's no temptation that's going to come your way that I won't give you the power to overcome, and if God says that to you and you believe it, then guess what? There is no temptation that can come your way that you don't have the power to overcome. And I just went, okay, I believe it. And boom, never touched, never craved, never thought about, never wanted to touch any of that white powder ever again. And so every year on the 4th of July, that's my Independence Day. And I didn't know this at the time, but I've since been told that, according to physicians, that that particular addiction physically is the hardest to break, to kick. And by the power of God, just like that, without even a struggle. And I know it was the power of God because I had a big bag of it in my dresser drawer. And I just gave it back to the guy I got it from. I couldn't flush it because I owed $2,000, you know. But I didn't use it, and I didn't sell it. I just gave it back and said, thanks, but no thanks. We're done. You know, you remember the date of your spiritual birthday or some anniversary of some deliverance, you know. And what the thing is, I've never been tempted to relapse. You know, I remember shortly after that, I've had, you know, some buddies who were still into that, and maybe some of them still are, and they'd kind of go, hey, you want a little, you know, and no, all I got to do is think back, and I started to get a stiff neck just thinking about it, you know, no interest whatsoever. And it's, you know, on the 4th of July every year, I remember that. That's that anniversary that reminds me of where I was and how far the Lord has brought me. It's important to have a date like that. And I just want to point out a couple things in verse 14. On that day, okay, remember the date. On that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they feared him as they had feared Moses all the days of his life. Well, I read that, and why? I mean, that doesn't seem right. If you read it from a certain perspective, the Lord lifted up Joshua and made him the big kahuna over the entire 2.5 million people. Now, that's not what's going on there. He exalted Joshua not because Joshua was special, but because Joshua was obedient. And Joshua was a man of faith. Because, you know, it wasn't about Joshua, it was about the Lord. It was Joshua's faith that pleased the Lord, and that's why the Lord chose him to lead his people. See, the only qualification, whether you're leading a Bible study or a church or a movement, I think we've got enough movements, but, you know, if, play along. The qualification the Lord is looking for is faith, unwavering trust, belief that what he says is true and what he says is going to happen is going to happen. Now look down at verse 19, the last verse in this section. Now the people came up from the Jordan. This is kind of a recap again of the overall story. They came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And notice that it's, what does he call it here? The 10th day of the first month. Hold your place in Joshua and turn back to Exodus 12. Exodus is the second book of the Bible. It's right after Genesis, the 12th chapter. There have been 10 plagues in Egypt. Still, Pharaoh won't let the people go. And now, finally, it's the Passover, where the firstborn of every family, even firstborn of the animals that don't have the blood of the Passover lamb painted on their doorpost, is going to be taken. And here we are in chapter 12. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. So the Lord sort of restarted the calendar. Can you imagine something so dramatic in our day that the, I don't know who would make that call, but they would say, from now on, this is the start of the new year. But that's basically what the Lord did. Verse 3, speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And he goes on to explain the Passover. Take a lamb without blemish, you know, slaughter it, and eat the meal standing up and ready to go, because as soon as this happens, the Pharaoh's going to let you go. Well, what we're looking at here in Joshua 4:19 is exactly 40 years later. Exactly. 40 years to the day. The 10th of the month. Now, why 40? Well, if you're into Jewish numerology, you'll understand that 40 is the number of judgment. 39 is the number of mercy. That's why when they would flog someone, 39 stripes, they were showing mercy, because one more would be 40, it would be judgment. 7 in Jewish numerology is the number of completion and so forth. There's all those numbers. The reason is because the numbers, this is kind of by the way, the numbers in the Jewish alphabet are the same as certain letters. They don't have separate, you know, we have letters and then we have numbers. Well, they have, some of the letters are also numbers. Anyway, 40 for judgment. Now, here's what we want to see in this, exactly 40 years later, what the law represented by Moses could not do, faith represented by Joshua would finally accomplish after judgment. Now, for them, it's 40 years in the desert. That's the judgment for their disobedience and their disbelief. But the judgment for our sin is the cross. What the law couldn't do is possible only by faith, because of the judgment on the cross. It's because of the cross, where Jesus gave his life for sin, that we have God's life and God's Spirit within us. It's because of the cross that our sin is forgiven, that the stain of sin is removed, the curtain that separated us from God's presence was torn in two, literally and figuratively. And that's why Romans 5 can say, therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom also we have access by faith into this grace in which we stand and rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. Now, the last four verses in this chapter are really the heart of the passage. And what they tell us is that it's always important to remember the Lord's faithfulness. Sometimes it's important to remember the decision. Sometimes it's important to remember the day or the date. But it's always important to remember the Lord's faithfulness. Verse 20, and those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up in Gilgal. And then he spoke to the children of Israel, saying, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what are these stones? Then you shall let your children know, saying, Israel crossed over this Jordan on dry land. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we had crossed over. That all the peoples of the earth may know the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. Remembering the Lord's faithfulness. You know, remembering the Lord's faithfulness is exactly what we do every time we share communion. When you read those accounts in the Gospels of that Last Supper and the First Communion, how many times did Jesus say, remember, remember, remember? I haven't counted them, but it would be an interesting thing to do. He said, this is my body broken for you. Remember. This is my blood shed for you. Remember. This is the new covenant, a new contract in my blood. Remember. It's a new covenant that's based on grace, not law. It's based on faith, not works. Remember, remember, remember. Verse 23. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you. Let me ask you a question. What waters has the Lord dried up before you to make it possible for you to move into the promised land, the full life, the spirit-filled life that he promised? Did he dry up doubt? Did he dry up addiction, heartbreak, abuse, neglect, loneliness? Remember his faithfulness in those things. And remember this, the Lord brings you out to bring you in. He brings you out of the desert, out of the past, to bring you into the promised land, into his kingdom. He doesn't deliver you from slavery and then leave you in the desert. He sets you free in order to fill your life with his goodness, with his grace. And it's important to remember that. It's important to memorialize that. That's what this chapter is all about. A while back, we showed a video of a band I was in. It's been 20 years. I can't believe that. 20 years ago. 20 years ago, if I would have said 20 years ago, I would have been in the third grade. But anyway, 20 years ago today, when I was a new believer, I was in this Christian band called Makaira. And I played you a video one day, and you've seen the pictures of me with the long hair and the dangly earring. Got a big hoot out of that, I know. Just last week or the week before, there's been some talk of a reunion, you know. And so I had to kind of get out some of those old songs that I'd written for that band. And I got to learn them if we're going to do this. I got to know the words and remember how they go. And I got to tell you, reading and sort of reliving where I was at when I wrote those songs has really been a startling experience. You know, I mean, the Lord brought me out to bring me in, but I forgot just how deep that deliverance was, and then just how equally deep that freedom was that he brought me to, you know, to look back and remember where I came from and remember the Lord's faithfulness. It just blows my mind. And so for me, those songs are like a memorial. It's like a pile of rocks. Now, verse 21, and we'll close with this. Then he spoke to the children of Israel, saying, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what are these stones? Then you shall let your children know, saying, Israel crossed over this Jordan on dry land. It's up to us to teach the next generation. When my kids and my grandkids see that picture of me with the dangly earring and the long hair, they're going to know that's when the Lord reached down and changed Grandpa's life. See, they're going to know that because I tell them. I've told them, and I'm going to keep telling them. And when they get out that cassette before CDs, that cassette tape, they're going to be reminded that, oh yeah, this is, you know, these songs are my grandpa's testimony. You know, this one song, this is kind of vague, but some of you might get it. The verse was, loaded like a pistol, feel the powder burn, reaching out for you at the point of no return. And in my darkest hour, you called by name. And now I'm changing. I'll never be the same. Whether it's a decision, a date, or a dangly earring, doesn't matter. What matters is that you remember where you've been, how far you've come, and who got you here. And whether you stack up some rocks or circle a date on a calendar, a meaningful memorial will help you remember the Lord's faithfulness. And that makes me want to sing. Great is thy faithfulness, O God, my Father. There is no shadow of turning with thee. Thou changest not, thy compassions, they fail not. As thou hast been, thou forever will be.